Appeals is now in session. Judge Brian, Judge Johnson, Judge Bratfold, the Honorable Jeffrey M. Brian presiding. Calling case number 822-0621, State of Minnesota, respondent versus Willie B. Brown, Jr., appellant.
Thank you. May be seated. Good morning. We are here today. We have two cases set for oral argument, and one is set for non-oral consideration. I do have a couple of opening remarks before we begin, and that is that, as you can see, there's some options for you, three different podiums. The one in the middle is the one that can go up and down and adjusts. That way it also, I think, has the best view of the clock. But you can take your pick if you prefer to be the podium next to you. It's something we implemented as we returned from COVID and began hearing arguments in person again. So up to you. The only other thing I will say, I know both parties are familiar with our process, is if you would please take a moment when you begin speaking to pronounce your name for us so we know how it should be pronounced, and also that of your client, and let us know if you or your client have any preferences that we should know about when referring to you. And with that, are you both prepared to proceed this morning? Okay. Go ahead, counsel for appellant.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Andrea Bartz. I'm an assistant state public defender, and I represent the appellant, Willie Brown, Jr. Mr. Brown was convicted of the second-degree intentional murder of DH after this court remanded his case for a new trial. We're here today because the district court violated this court's previous opinion when it admitted Sprigle evidence that Brown committed a drive-by shooting offense 2.5 hours after the murder. This court already held that the district court improperly joined the drive-by and the murder offenses into one trial and that a remand was required for separate trials, because the drive-by offense was not admissible as Sprigle evidence in the murder trial. This court remanded for separate proceedings because the error in joining the two offenses was too prejudicial. In order to remand the case, this court had to determine if each offense would be admissible as Sprigle evidence in a trial for the other offense. This court held that each offense was not admissible in a trial for the other offense, so this court remanded. This court held already that the probative value of the Sprigle evidence was outweighed by its potential for unfair prejudice.
Now, if I can jump in at this point, because I think the argument in response is this isn't a law of the case kind of an issue. This is really something different. What do you think was precisely before the panel in the last appeal? And is that different from what's before us today?
It's exactly the same, Your Honor. This court had to engage in the Sprigle analysis under the fifth factor for admission under 404B. That's what this court analyzed, and it used the same evidence to do so and said that it was inadmissible. So the law of the case doctrine applies. It's the same issue considered and adjudicated by this court.
I understand it's similar. Do you think it's exactly the same? You don't see any distinctions at all?
The evidence admitted was summarized, or the evidence considered by this court previously was already summarized by this court, and that evidence is that TF looked out the window, observed Brown driving by the Sheridan residence in an Impala, firing a gun. Despite this court's opinion, TF was allowed to testify that she was inside her home on Sheridan Avenue. She looked outside, saw Brown driving the Impala on Sheridan. He was holding a gun, and he fired the gun as he drove by. Then she called the police. It's the same evidence that was already analyzed by this court and deemed to be inadmissible. So this court already held that a district court would commit error if it admitted the evidence of the drive-by shooting in the trial for DH's murder. And this court meant what it held on page 11 of this court's prior opinion.
Ms. Bartz? So I'm looking at the last paragraph of part one of the prior Brown opinion. Yeah, I don't have the page number exactly. I have a Westlaw printout. But it's the paragraph that begins on remand. I'll give you a second to find it.
Does it entail one joinder?
Well, I'm thinking the last paragraph in part one, right before the heading in part two, the last paragraph begins on remand.
Yeah, okay, sorry.
Okay, yeah, so your argument is that the district court's ruling in the second trial violated this court's opinion. But is there something in this paragraph specifically that you think was violated by the trial court's ruling on retrial?
So this court's opinion and holding that I'm referring to is on the previous page, page 11.
Right.
Under number one. So number two is about hypothetical intrinsic evidence, and that's not what the district court even ruled.
Okay, so I guess we got I'm thinking Roman. Okay, I apologize. I was thinking Roman numeral one, and I'm thinking the paragraph right before the heading Roman numeral two. And I'm sorry it's taking me so long to set up my question, but I guess I'm just, you know, this paragraph, if you're oriented to the paragraph, talks about what the district court may and may not do on remand. And I guess if your argument is that the district court ruling was contrary to our opinion, can you be more specific with respect to this paragraph?
Definitely. So I'm referring to the drive-by evidence that Mr. Brown drove by the Sheraton residence where TF lived in the Apollo.
There was no use of the word drive-by, right?
Yes, there was. Yes, there was. On page 291 to 293, the state asked if he was driving by, and she said he did. So, and then it's repeatedly referred to over and over after that as him driving by. So it's exactly the same behavior that this court already considered in its previous opinion and said would be too prejudicial to be admitted. And if I could draw this court's attention to the paragraph in that that you're referring to, the sentence here. It says, for example, as noted above, they're referring to what they already said in number one, that it would be too prejudicial. And then the court says, evidence of Brown shooting at the Sheraton Avenue address would have very little added probative value, but carries a high risk of unfair prejudice in the murder trial. So they're saying it's
right,
too...
Right, but that's why I was asking the similar questions, and I appreciate Judge Johnson directing our attention to that paragraph. Was there evidence admitted of Brown shooting at the Sheraton Avenue address? And I'm quoting that same part that you just quoted. Shooting at the address.
Well,
or is that a distinction that you can make
between
what was...
When this court's just referring to where it occurred, that he's shooting at the Sheraton address, that's where he's driving by and shooting, is at the Sheraton address. And it's clear based on TF's testimony that she was inside her home with a bunch of other people. She looked outside. He's driving by in the black Impala, which was the DH's car. He's driving on Sheraton. He's holding a gun. He discharges the gun as he drove by.
So you
then
would,
she calls the police. I mean, it's
so you would interpret
it's a drive-by.
That sentence not to say shooting toward the Sheraton Avenue house.
That's not required that he would shoot directly toward her or toward her house. He's discharging a gun from a motor vehicle. To any juror, that means he's committing a drive-by. He's driving by and shooting. It's a crowded neighborhood in Minneapolis. There's a bunch of people in the house. Under the statute, it's just shooting at or toward a building or motor vehicle or person. So I don't think we have to meet each element of the statute. That's not what this is about. It's about the jury's deliberations and how they would be affected by hearing this behavior, which amounts to a drive-by offense. It's the same testimony that this court already analyzed and deemed inadmissible. So the law of the case... law of the case doctrine applied, and the district court could not admit the Spriegel evidence of the drive-by in the murder trial. And
so, counsel, law of the case isn't really a doctrine, right? It's a rule of practice.
Yeah.
And I noticed that you cited civil cases to support your position. Are you aware of any criminal cases that have applied law of the case?
I am not.
Okay. And then the other question I had for you is, if it is a rule of practice, right, which is the way it's always been described, in Minnesota. How does that affect your analysis as opposed to a rule such as, you know, res judicata, which would be a lot firmer in terms of how this court, or a failure of a district court to follow remand instructions, which I wondered if that was really your argument, if it's the district court failed to follow remand instructions.
I believe this court did hold repeatedly that it would be error to admit evidence of this drive-by in the murder trial, and that's exactly what happened.
I quibble a bit with that, because when you use the word hold, and you did it really carefully in your opening remarks, I mean, it's certainly true that Brown 1 held that the district court's decision to join the two offenses, the drive-by and the murder 2, that was error. I mean, that necessitated a new trial. There's no doubt about that. Whether Brown 1, this court in Brown 1, actually held that the evidence that was heard in the second case was inadmissible under Spriegel, the second trial. That's where I'm not quite sure that the evidence was exactly the same. You're right, there's, in many ways the evidence is very similar, but I guess what I'm waiting to hear from you is, when this case did go back for a second trial, there was a hearing on the Spriegel issue, and the district court made a number of comments in an effort to limit the evidence that was introduced on the, what we're calling the drive-by shooting, right? The shooting as the defendant drove past the Sheridan Avenue residence after the killing of DH.
So in order to remand this case, mm-hmm. the last time, this court had to consider specifically whether the drive-by would be admissible as Spriegel evidence in the murder, and this court had to decide that it would not in order to remand it. So the case was definitely remanded, and this court held that the drive-by wasn't admissible in a trial for the murder in order to do so. And the only way that law of the case would not apply is if the evidence upon which this court based its previous decision that I've just summarized, if that evidence was substantially different than in this appeal. And as I've laid out for the court, it was not. The evidence summarized by this court about TF's testimony that Brown drove by on Sheridan in the Impala firing the gun is the same as the evidence that was admitted through her testimony in this second trial. So in that case that I've cited about the fact that it needs to be substantially different is Peterson versus BASF at 66.
The civil case. Yeah, I understand.
Yes.
So here's what I'd like to ask you. If we don't agree with you on your law of the case analysis, and instead we do a fresh review of this evidence under the Spriegel rules, it appeared to me from reading your brief that there are five considerations under Spriegel. It appeared to me that your analysis is questioning the fourth and fifth factors. Am I right about that?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. All right.
So even if law of the case does not apply, the Spriegel evidence should not have been admitted because the danger of unfair prejudice was too great to Mr. Brown.
So that's the fifth factor, right?
Yes. Okay. Yes. And I have laid out both in my brief.
You have.
The potential that the drive-by evidence had to unfairly prejudice Brown outweighed its probative value. It suggested he had a general propensity for violence and using a gun, and it attacked his character.
You make a comment in your brief about the district court's limiting instruction, right? And I'm sure you're aware in the Smith case that seemed to be a very important, which is a case cited by the district court here. It's a Minnesota Supreme Court case in which the Supreme Court looked at some evidence that was offered in obviously a very different case, different context, but where the state offered evidence that a defendant had shot a weapon close in time to the murder that was at issue in that case. And the Supreme Court in Smith emphasized the limiting instructions as one of their reasons for determining that the probative value of the Spriegel evidence in that case did outweigh the prejudicial effect. So would you help me out and understand your position on the limiting instructions given in Mr. Brown's case?
Sure. So I think the limiting instructions would go to whether the error was harmless or not. And in this case, limiting...
Do you think it shouldn't be discussed at all in the fifth factor?
The jury instructions?
Correct.
This was a decision the court made pre-trial.
No, I understand
admissible.
That. But I understand that. But you remember, I mean, our district court judge, one of the things that the court considered was, well, this evidence is going to be offered. I'm giving the parties some instructions on how the evidence will be limited, and I will also instruct the jury on how the evidence should be considered or interpreted. And we, of course,
Certainly.
Have pattern instructions that are used. You briefed this issue. I mean,
yes.
I'm just trying to make sure I understand your position. It seems to me that in the Smith decision, our Supreme Court suggests that one of the things we should look at in reviewing Spriegel evidence is the impact. You know, what is the limiting instruction that's given? How will it guide the jury's understanding of the Spriegel evidence? And so help me understand your view of how the limiting instructions that were given in this case affect our analysis on the fifth factor.
Sure. This court can consider it, but I think it goes more to whether the error was harmless. And telling the jury to use the drive-by to determine whether or not Brown was guilty of the murder isn't fair, because that evidence was inadmissible in the first place, because it's has more danger for prejudice than it has probative value. So telling the jury to use it to determine guilt just draws more attention to it and makes it more harmful. And the court explains that in the Minnesota Supreme Court in Stroman. So a new trial would be required here because there's a reasonable possibility that the wrongfully admitted evidence significantly affected the verdict. And in footnote 10, this court even said that it only examined
footnote
whether admission of this court's previous opinion.
Okay.
Footnote 10, this court said it only examined whether admission of the Spriegel evidence would constitute error. But then it said, quote, nevertheless, in this case, the strength of the state's evidence is not sufficient to render harmless the erroneous admission of the evidence of one offense in the trial for the other. So this court has already recognized how harmful this evidence was to Mr. Brown, because it was character evidence that showed how violent he was and he had a propensity to use guns in a murder trial for DH. I'm out of time. I will address any additional questions on rebuttal. Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel. I'm Assistant Hennepin County Attorney Adam Petras, and I represent the respondent in this matter, the state of Minnesota. I understand that on its face, it can seem problematic if this court reverses a pair of convictions for offenses because those offenses were improperly joined, and then, on remand, one of those offenses is spriegled into the trial of the other offense. I get that. Honestly, that does not fairly or completely describe, as this court's questions before were driving at, what happened in this case. In this court's prior opinion, which I understand Judge Bryan wrote, this court reversed appellant's convictions for second-degree murder and drive-by shooting. It also expressly held that there was sufficient evidence of appellant's guilt of second-degree murder, and because of that, it remanded those cases for separate proceedings. This court, in its prior opinion, analyzed the hypothetical admissibility of appellant's drive-by offense based on the facts that were presented in appellant's first trial. As Spriegel evidence in a hypothetical trial for that second-degree murder offense as part of its joinder analysis. This court concluded that drive-by shooting evidence, again, as that evidence was fully and thoroughly presented at appellant's first trial, had almost no probative value to show, quote, intent or motive for killing DH, end quote. That's at pin site 11 of the prior opinion. But although this court concluded it would be error to allow evidence of the drive-by shooting or second-degree assault in the trial for DH's murder, this court did not analyze the possibility of introducing only limited relevant underlying facts of that conduct without referencing the additional facts, such as where the gunshots were directed, that established that appellant committed a drive-by shooting or second-degree assault. And that is what minimizes any potential unfair prejudicial inference of that evidence. At appellant's remanded second-degree murder trial, Judge Garcia allowed the state to offer limited Spriegel evidence that is consistent with this court's prior opinion. The state did not present evidence that could establish appellant committed drive-by shooting or second-degree assault, which would require proof that appellant fired a gun from the vehicle at a residence. Instead, the state sanitized and limited this evidence with Judge Garcia's direction and presented only that which was necessary to prove a highly relevant and material fact. That
so do you disagree with appellant's description of the transcript as a number of witnesses referring to Mr. Brown as driving by the Sheridan Avenue residence? Well, a number of witnesses. It's primarily one witness. But driving by the Sheridan Avenue residence and shooting or discharging his gun.
If you, volume three of the transcript is a PDF. It's completely searchable. I believe the page numbers that Ms. Bartsch just referenced were page 291 to 293. If you do a control find in volume three, that PDF, for either drive by or driving by, the only references to drive by, and there are six of them, are when Judge Garcia is explaining her ruling outside the presence of the jury before opening statements. The only reference to the phrase driving by is actually made in the state's opening statement at pages 127 to 128. If you look and read very carefully when TH, the witness at issue, is testifying on pages 291 to 293, she does use the word driving, and she does say that she saw appellant with a gun, but the words drive by or driving by never come out of her mouth, or she does not agree with those words and presented in the form of a question to her. The material fact
so
is that
your view that that is consistent with the limiting its directions of the district court when the district court ruled on the admissibility in the second trial,
both with the limiting instructions and the direction that Judge Garcia gave to the parties, as well as in this court's prior opinion. In that paragraph that Judge Johnson was highlighting before, that third sentence from the end before Roman numeral two, where this court wrote, for example, as noted above, evidence of Brown shooting at the Sheridan Avenue address would have very little added probative value. At or toward was specifically chosen. At or toward is the language in the drive-by drive-by shooting statute. And I disagree with Ms. Bart's characterization that it would have impacted or affected the jury regardless. In any separate, unrelated drive-by shooting offense, a jury is asked to interpret those very words, the difference between shooting at or toward something or just shooting a gun generally. As I point out in my brief, I think the facts as they came in under TH's testimony at the second remanded trial probably amounted to the reckless discharge that I cited. That's 609.66, I believe it's subdivision 1E. But that it's not a drive-by shooting offense, and which is obviously a much more higher severity level offense as indicated by the punishment. But a jury is asked to distinguish between an individual's conduct all the time and whether the shooting was just up in the air or in any random direction or specifically at a residence or toward a residence. The material fact that no other evidence conclusively established in this case but the limited sanitized Spriegel evidence did is that appellant possessed the murder weapon, the very murder weapon, a couple hours after the murder. And ultimately, Judge Garcia has the discretion, and it's an abuse of discretion standard that this court is applying to her evidentiary ruling here, and she did not abuse that discretion in her careful ruling that admitted the limited evidence establishing that fact.
Mr. Petras, let me draw your attention back to that paragraph. The second to last sentence expresses concern about evidence that Brown discharged a firearm. And it's in reference, I think, to the testimony about his presence and conduct on Thomas Avenue, I believe. But still, I mean, there was concern expressed in our prior opinion about evidence of him discharging a firearm in an incident separate from the killing.
I agree, just given that the two witnesses that are referenced in that second to last sentence, Your Honor, that is referring to the Thomas Avenue evidence, if that can somehow be compartmentalized here. But I would say
the spirit of the reasoning there, I think, is that evidence of another act of discharging a firearm has prejudicial value.
If we're reading and doing a strict grammatical analysis of how that sentence is written, I believe what this court, in the opinion written by Judge Bryan, is saying in that sense is it's offering an example of what could happen. It's not saying what could not. That's how I read it. The sentence being, the district court could admit evidence that Brown drove the Black Impala and came to a sudden stop in front of JP and AG's residence without admitting evidence that he discharged a firearm. And I understand, Judge Johnson, your point about the spirit of that sentence. And this evidence was prejudicial, as all evidence is. I do not believe it was unfairly prejudicial, and the discharge piece was critical to establishing that relevant and material fact that it is the same gun, because it is the discharge cartridge casings, the DCC, the one discharge cartridge casing, because, again, in that second trial, rather than the multiple gunshots that appellant fired at TH's residence, that's not how the evidence came in. It came in as a single gunshot, one, a single cartridge. I believe it was, I think it was Exhibit 339 in the trial that was the actual discharge cartridge casing that was recovered on Sheridan Avenue. And that was essential because that is what was used by the forensic analysis to match it up with the Smith & Wesson gun and with the discharge cartridge casing and then the bullet that was recovered where DH was killed.
And so without that evidence, without evidence of a discharge in front of the Sheridan Avenue house, without evidence of that DCC,
there'd be no way of linking that cartridge to the gun.
How could the jury have gone astray, in your view? What's your position about how you would prevented from proving, you know, from every link in the chain? Can you explain that for us, please?
If without the discharge cartridge casing,
right,
the jury would have been prevented?
Well, yeah, I mean, how... I mean, if the district court had excluded evidence of that he discharged a firearm outside of the in front of the Sheridan house, and then how would your evidence have been lacking or less persuasive, or how might the jury have acquitted, without that evidence going in?
I'll answer your question two different ways, Judge Johnson. First off, in terms of the link between the different pieces of evidence, without the testimony from TH, which was very limited, 6 lines on page 291 of the transcript, that a gun held by appellant was discharged on Sheridan Avenue. Without that evidence, there would be nothing tying the cartridge casing that was found on Sheridan Avenue with the gun that was recovered in the gutter of the detached garage when you're walking from Thomas Avenue to Sheridan Avenue. And, of course, that gun is the one that was found to have killed DH, but there was nothing tying the appellant's possession of that gun without that discharge cartridge casing, because there's nothing showing that he was in possession of it. I understand the thumbprint on the extended magazine. I understand the extended magazine, a extended magazine being seen in appellant's pocket at some point between the murder around 5 a.m. and when he was arrested on Sheridan Avenue back between 7 and 7:30 a.m. But again, that's circumstantial and inferential. What we have here is the appellant literally holding the murder weapon. You know, it's because it's linked to the cartridge casings then that were found at the actual scene of DH's death. So the discharge in the limited way that it came in the second trial with this a single cartridge casing and discharge not pointed at or towards anything, but pointed just discharged. Could have been anywhere. Again, you could not have established, you know, drive-by shooting based on the facts that were admitted at that second trial. I think it was critical establishing that fact. I also sense, Judge Johnson, I apologize if I'm misconstruing it, maybe a harmlessness question or aspect to your question?
So much.
Okay. Well, then I will go there.
You are demonstrating quite a strong command of the transcript in the second trial. I'm wondering if you can contrast with the evidence in the first trial. Was it similar in terms of discharge, or was it drive-by or driving by, or what do you recall of the of the evidence that would have been before this court the first time?
A disclaimer is that I specifically did not read any part of the transcript of the first trial because I did not want to confuse the facts from the first trial for the second trial. But what I will say is there was enough evidence of multiple gunshots being directed at the address on Sheridan Avenue in the first trial to sufficiently establish a drive-by shooting offense. And that was clearly not what occurred in the second trial. Again, if you're looking just at those six lines of transcript or six lines on a single page of transcript, that being on page 291.
You were about to talk about harmlessness, and I was curious if you could draw contrast at all or distinguish between the legal issues that were before the court the first time and what is before us today. You know, we're applying a portion of Spriegel to determine error for joinder. In the first instance, how is that different or similar to what we're doing now?
It was much more complicated in the first trial. There were four different claims that were before this court: the blood test evidence, the motion to suppress, the joinder, and then the part of that joinder being this hypothetical, as this court described in its opinion, Spriegel analysis. And then there was all the relationship evidence, too, that, of course, was precluded and then not touched at all in the second remanded trial. I feel this is a much more straightforward.
Right, but as a legal decision, is there a difference, do you think, between the hypothetical analysis and the actual analysis that was done on the second trial and that we're reviewing?
I don't think there's necessarily a leap.
It relates to harmlessness, for example.
Sure. I don't think there's necessarily a distinction, legally speaking, but I think there is obviously a great one factually. And I think that like the difference in facts that were admitted both in the context of this particular Spriegel evidence as compared to the full-fledged prosecution for drive-by shooting that occurred at the first trial, as well as, I believe, the argument, having actually listened to the oral argument that happened in this case earlier that you participated in, Judge Bryan, it was a lot of there are so many different claims here and that they all may be infected. I believe the claim that was presented to this court is it was a violation of a fair trial because of all this prejudicial evidence, you know, that came in both in the sense of the joinder as well as in the blood test evidence, the show up, the relationship evidence. I understand that's not necessarily how this court's opinion reads, but my understanding is that that's how it was presented to this court.
Could you help me understand one piece of evidence, and that is my understanding is TF testified that early that morning, after the killing, before Brown's arrest, she saw him with a clip sticking out of his pocket, but she did not see a weapon. The clip is, you know, separate from the weapon. Is that correct?
That is correct. Mm-hmm.
And was she able to identify or associate that clip with a certain weapon?
Judge Bryan, I see I'm out of time. Can I finish answering Judge Johnson's question?
Yes.
I don't believe so at any point in her testimony. I think that an inference could be drawn from that, but it's by no means conclusive. And if all that was seen was a clip, it could have been connected to a gun. It also, as being an extended clip and its length, as illustrated in the trial exhibits, it may have been separate from that gun, which is a point that Judge Garcia, in her written order, she obviously ruled both orally and in a written order, admitting the limited Santi-Spriegel evidence in this case, drives in on, which is at pages 4 to 5 of that written order about a thumbprint being on the magazine as opposed on the actual portion of the weapon or the weapon itself that would have caused the harm and killed DH, as there not being conclusive by any means that he was wielding the weapon at any point, appellant that is.
And is the word clip and magazine, are those synonymous?
I am using those interchangeably. I'm by no means a firearms expert, and I believe there is a perhaps a distinction to be made by people more well-versed in that area than I am. But I'm using that interchangeably. I believe how this court referred to it and how the evidence came in is that it was an extended magazine.
Okay. Thank you.
I just wanted to quick summarize some of the evidence. TF saw Brown leave with DH in the Impala before the murder. Then Furman, who lives at the location where DH was murdered, saw a man matching Brown's general description at the murder scene. Then TF sees Brown again with an extended clip back at the Sheridan address at 5:19 a.m. The murder had been at about 5 a.m. TF saw Brown next to the Impala again at 6 a.m. Then the car wash video shows the car at the car wash until about 7 a.m. At 8 a.m., the neighbors see Brown drive up in the Impala and walk toward Sheridan address. Brown was arrested in the yard at Sheridan at about 8 a.m. The Smith & Wesson was found in the gutter on his path to Sheridan with the magazine in it. And the magazine had his fingerprint on it. And then the bullet projectile in DH's neck matched the Smith & Wesson. And a bullet in the car matched the Smith & Wesson. And then there was blood on the magazine that matched DH's DNA. Brown didn't have an alibi. The state doesn't need this evidence of the drive-by. The evidence about the drive-by has very low probative value, and this court already recognized that in its previous decision.
I think two separate issues, right? Whether it has probative value and whether the state needs it. I mean, it could have probative value, but you're saying the state...
Given the other evidence, it has very low probative value, Your Honor.
So and no, this low court, additional probative, marginal probative value, that's your argument.
This court already recognized that on page 14. That's,
but I think you're also arguing there's too much probative value, right? It's too powerful, too likely to
well, it's going to be used improperly by the jury because it amounts to character evidence that's not admissible in the state of Minnesota unless it meets these requirements. And the court already said in its opinion on page 14 that evidence of Brown shooting at the Sheridan address would have very little added probative value, carries a high risk of unfair prejudice in the murder trial, and that it would be error for the court to admit evidence of the drive-by at the murder trial.
So, counsel, if you'd indulge me just a little bit, instead of relying on your law of the case argument, instead focus on the fourth and fifth factors in the Spriegel analysis and help me out, because the argument that I'd love to hear your response to that Mr. Petras made involves the DCC, right? The ballistics and the other forensic evidence for the discharge casing that was found in front of the Sheridan Avenue residence, right? So that matches the murder weapon, correct? That's what the forensic evidence shows.
It shows that the DCC was fired from the Smith & Wesson gun.
Right. Yeah.
And we also have TF seeing Brown with the extended magazine hanging out of his pocket.
And she knows that that was the murder weapon, so she was able to say that?
At about, I mean, it was found with the magazine in the murder weapon.
And I understand.
The magazine has DH's blood on it. And
how do we know that the murder weapon was recovered from a gutter in a garage, right?
Yes, the neighbors yes. testified they saw Brown pull up in the Impala, which is the victim's car. It's full of blood inside. He gets out. He walks in through the yards to the Sheridan address. They say he looks like he's carrying something. He walks up. Police are already at the Sheridan address. They arrest him. The cop walks back on the path and finds the guns in the gutter. The magazine is in the gun, which then is tested, and it shows that that gun fired the projectile that was in DH's neck and the projectiles in the car. So I don't know what probative value additional evidence about a drive-by shooting 2.5 hours after the murder has, given the other
evidence. And again, I'm not asking you to talk so much about it. I mean, you okay. can refer to it as the drive-by shooting all that you'd like, but the argument that was made by opposing counsel relates much more to the forensic analysis for the discharge casing that was found, right? And it's linking that casing to Mr. Brown that is the probative value we're being asked under the Spriegel analysis to evaluate.
So the state argued that it showed opportunity, ability to commit the crime, but that wasn't really disputed.
Opportunity to have the murder weapon, right? Yes.
So he was
it's placing the murder weapon in Mr. Brown's hands. I mean, that, in all fairness, I think that's the state's argument. So that's what I would love to hear your take on that. I appreciate that what you're saying is it's clearly outweighed by the prejudicial effect. I understand that. But in terms of probative value, there's certainly some probative value, right?
It's very minimal, and it doesn't compare. It's outweighed by the danger of unfair prejudice to Brown. And I just wanted to quickly, before I'm out of time, tell you on 292, the state asked TF, did you see him discharge the gun as he drove by? She said, I did. That is a drive-by. There is a reasonable probability that this affected the verdict, and we would ask for a new trial. I'm out of time. Thank you.
Well, thank you both for your arguments today. We will take the matter under advisement and issue an opinion within the statutory time frame. Have a nice day. Good morning. I will make a couple opening remarks before we begin this morning. First of all, you see you've got a couple of podiums there to choose from. The one in the middle is adjustable and has a view of the clock, but we allow attorneys, if they prefer, to use the one next to their counsel table in the interest of distancing, if necessary, and so we leave it up to you to decide which you want. Before you begin, I would also ask that you pronounce your name for us and the name of your client so that we know how it should be pronounced, and let us know if there are any preferences that you have for how we should refer to you or your client today. And with that, are the attorneys prepared to proceed?
Yes, thank you.
Yes.
Okay. And I'm not sure, is it... I'll let you tell me how to pronounce your name, sir. Go ahead, counsel.
Kala.
Kala.
Like cauliflower, right. good morning. May it please the court. My name is Christopher Kala. I represent the appellant, Olson Property Investments, LLC. I will refer to them as the landlord. They are the owner and landlord of residential rental property located in Farmington, Minnesota. The building at issue is a triplex. Respondents are the former tenants who have since been evicted. This appeal presents from that eviction action resolved in favor of the landlord as to the issue of possession. There was a bench trial. But the trial court, in its decision, denied the landlord its attorney's fees and costs and disbursements without explanation. This appeal is on the limited issue of attorney's fees, costs, and disbursements. Possession is not an issue. There was no cross appeal. The standard of review is abuse of discretion. There are no facts at issue in this case. The only piece of evidence this court needs to review is the lease, which is Exhibit 1. The eviction...
Mr. Callum,
yes, sir.
Could I just... I think the district court gave the parties an opportunity to file post-hearing briefs or memoranda. Is that right?
I believe so.
And did you file one?
Yes.
I don't see it in the district court record. I do see defendants' letter brief.
It may have been emailed to the court.
Okay. I'm wondering, at any time before the district court's decision, the order, did you present argument or evidence about cost or disbursements or attorney fees?
No. The issue of costs and disbursements and attorney's fees especially, it's not an issue of damages or special damages like might be
Understood.
Available on a defamation or a slander of title case. it's collateral to the issue that was being litigated.
I'm just wondering if you made any presentation to the district court, you know, to prompt it to do what you wanted them to do, and that any request that was contrary to what the district court actually did.
Well, it was in the complaint, the consolidated amended eviction complaint that was filed on January 26th at paragraph 13, plaintiff seeks all allowable costs and disbursements and an award of attorney's fees.
I mean, we have a rule of civil procedure about applying for cost and disbursements, right?
Yes.
But you didn't follow that procedure.
Well, the trial court had already denied that. To follow that procedure would be, I think, showing a bit of disrespect for the trial court and not first asking the trial court for permission to do so. And as this court has routinely held, post-trial motions and arguments in eviction proceedings are not appealable. Hypothetically, had we done that, and you know, we could have applied directly to the court administrator for costs and disbursements. My expectation is they would have denied that, simply looking at the trial court's order denying costs and disbursements.
And then you could have sought review by a district judge of the court administrator's decision.
Right, and against the backdrop of 504B371, which says the appeal deadline is 15 days from the entry of judgment, I'm not optimistic that all that could have transpired within those 15 days.
My understanding is that quite often taxation of costs and disbursements occurs. The rule says the application may be filed 45 days after the judgment. It's, you know, often post-judgment proceedings, and that if there is an award, then the court administrator will issue either a new judgment, maybe a separate judgment, maybe an amended judgment, which adds the amount to a money damages award. So there is eventually another judgment that could be appealed from.
Potentially. I'd direct the court to page 7 and 8 of my reply brief, where we cite the Tonkaway decision that kind of summarizes the types of post-trial motions that are not appealable. And it even talks about the Pushore versus Dale case that says, even orders which would be appealable in ordinary civil proceedings, such as a denial of a motion for a new trial, as in this case, are not appealable in unlawful detainer actions because the exclusive mode of an appeal is from a judgment of restitution. They distinguish evictions, which are summary proceedings, both limited in scope and duration for litigation, as different from an ordinary civil proceeding. I would grant you that if this was a standard breach of contract case, I actually had one not so long ago. It actually stemmed from a HOA statute, which had an attorney's fees shifting provision in it, and the trial court denied my client, who was the prevailing defendant in that case, also similarly denied attorney's fees and costs.
Are any of the cases that you're talking about and that you cite in the brief, are any of them specific to an issue like this, or are they more about new trial? When you say post-trial motions, are any of them specific to cost disbursements, attorney's fees?
I'm hesitant to say that this is a case of first impression, but I am unaware of any eviction cases that address the issue of post-trial motions that don't come from a perspective of a tenant trying to get their possession when they've lost at trial. I'm unaware of any case where the landlord, as a prevailing party, sought an appeal. But the attorney's fees in this case are significant, and for the court to simply deny, without explanation, costs, disbursements, and attorney's fees, I think is an abuse of discretion.
When you say the attorney's fees are significant, is there something that the district court would have known, other than the complaint, to know the amount, or something that the district court could have looked at to determine reasonableness of attorney's fees?
I'm not sure what this particular trial court judge's experience with evictions is, but the order that the court has lays out the procedural history fairly well. It's a big case. It was going on for a long time.
Right, but the length of litigation might be an indicator that attorney's fees, but you don't know until you see that affidavit what the fees really were, and you can't determine reasonableness until you've seen, assuming that they're asking for more than $1,000, you can't assess that So again, putting aside costs and disbursements for a second, just looking at attorney's fees, was there anything presented to the district court that would have established a basis to decide reasonableness of those fees?
No. And I would take the position that it wasn't relevant for the issue of possession. Evictions are about deciding possession of the property. No cross claims, no counterclaims. If there's a slip and fall of the tenant on the property, that's not within the scope of a summary proceeding of an eviction.
So is the complaint then enough, or is it required by the party seeking attorney's fees to present something in addition to a general statement in the complaint in order to avoid or to preserve the issue?
I think that's sufficient. I mean, the question for the trial court judge is, why would the trial court judge feel the need to deny attorney's fees and costs? The trial court could have simply been silent on the issue, and then the landlord, we would have submitted our application for attorney's fees and costs. And as Judge Johnson indicated, that might be a separate judgment that could be appealable by the tenants if they disagree with those reasonable attorney's fees and costs that the trial court might award. But to simply deny them without explanation, I think, is a clear abuse of discretion. I mean, all the trial court didn't have to do anything, but instead it was denied.
There was no request that was. The district court was not, reviewing or not ruling on a request by you, but I guess if we read it literally, making a sort of an advance ruling or a
preemptive.
And of course, this is, you know, we're assuming, I guess, as we must, that the district court intended what it wrote. It's also, you know, occurs to me that in reality it may have been some boilerplate that's included in the format of the district court's orders.
I clerked for a trial court judge for a couple of years. I understand, yes, that all the orders that come out from trial court judges might not be as vetted for every issue that could arise from how that particular order is worded. I get that. But the problem I have as the landlord's attorney is 504B371 establishes a very tight time frame to seek review of that. I did have a case a couple years ago that ended up at the Minnesota Supreme Court. It was the CHA versus Olson matter. The Supreme Court eventually established a new common law defense of retaliation. When that decision was issued by the jury, the special verdict form, it was slightly ambiguous. And I recognize that ambiguity presents my client with a problem for purposes of appeal. And so I approached Judge Burke and asked him, in the presence of the defendant, to delay his entry of judgment so that I could brief a post-trial matter for him regarding whether or not retaliation in a breach case is a defense to the eviction. And so judgment was suspended while that issue was briefed. We didn't have that opportunity here. Judgment was entered without any advance notice that the attorney's fees issue was going to be denied preemptively without any discussion with the parties. So I think in some instances, those standard expected post-trial discussions in ordinary civil cases can occur in an eviction proceeding, but there has to be some timing issues that fall just right.
So while you're talking about the ordinary civil practice versus eviction proceeding, I'm wondering if you can also address a question I had, because your brief relies on, as I understand it, the cost disbursements from Chapter 549. But there's also, is there not, a specific statutory provision regarding disbursements in eviction cases?
In Chapter 504B?
Correct.
I think 365. <clears throat> 504B-345 is the judgment execution.
Right, and I'm looking at, is it subdivision 1A? If fines for the plaintiff.
The court shall issue execution in favor of the plaintiff.
Shall tax the costs against the defendant. But I didn't see an argument based on that provision in your brief, and so therein lies my question. Are you only relying on the general statute, or are you relying on, you're not arguing to this court anything regarding application of 504B 345 sub 1A?
I did not cite that in my brief, and I'm embarrassed to admit that here, but I would suggest that that is an alternative base that this court could look to. I mean, it's certainly consistent with the basis that I do ask for an award of costs and disbursements.
I'm asking, is that proper for us to consider since it wasn't in the brief?
I'd have more of an issue for your decision-making process if that statute was contrary to the statute that I cite, but it's consistent. And I think oftentimes the case law, the statutes overlap in ways that are unexpected. Here, they overlap in a way that's consistent. I don't think the citations to 549 deny my client that right. I don't think that minimizes the argument just because there's a more on-point statutory.
I guess the difference would be that there's only the word costs. If I read 1A closely, but in the general statute, it does go on to also say reasonable disbursements. And again, we have that same question about reasonable disbursements as we would with reasonable attorney's fees, but assuming that there were no unreasonable disbursements in the case and we're only looking at disbursements, that's a distinction between the two statutes, I would think.
Potentially. And I don't get into the weeds too much on a deep dive of the distinction between costs and disbursements. This was not a complicated case in that regard. We've got filing fees. We've got a couple of appellate fees. We've got maybe one or two transcripts that are involved. But
anything that you would classify as disbursements?
With respect, I'd have to ask Your Honor what a disbursement is. I really don't do a lot of cost and disbursement motion practice in evictions. I don't even do many attorney's fees petitions in eviction practice, primarily because most tenants don't have them to pay. And most cases aren't large. This is, in my line of work, an excessive, a notable amount of attorney's fees that my client spent for a lot of litigation. Much of it I would characterize as unnecessary.
It seems that there are portions of respondent's brief that would potentially argue that there's a question of who the prevailing party was. And I'm wondering if you think that there's any chance the district court denied the general request from the complaint on the grounds that it determined that your client was not the prevailing party.
I did not glean that from their response. If you look at page 5 of their, and I cite that at page 9 of my 8 and 9 of my reply. This is the respondent at page 5. After trial, the district court issued an order concluding that respondents had failed to prove their affirmative defenses, that respondent Alexander's violation of the restraining orders against a principal and an employee of appellant was a violation of the crime-free lease addendum, and that because the party's lease had expired, respondents had become tenants at will, permitting appellant to provide a 14-day notice to quit, as provided in 504B135.
I guess I'm looking at pages 6 and 7 of the response brief that says appellant only prevailed, again, it seems to concede the prevailing party, but only prevailed after 2 years of litigation, a dismissal of the first eviction action, and two unsuccessful appeals, referring to the procedural history as tortuous. I guess the question might be, are there some cost disbursements fees that are associated only with some portion that was dismissed or some portion that was not successful on your end. And so there would be a time at which the prevailing party changed. And so fees up until that point in time would be denied, potentially cost disbursements as well. And so there seems to be the language of 6 to 7 suggests that there might be an open question as to who and when the prevailing party, when does that begin?
Sure. I think if you were to compare that perhaps to a complaint that has 10 causes of action, goes on for years, hundreds of thousands of dollars involved, and the plaintiff prevails on only one issue, I think the court might have some leeway to say, Look, you litigated 10 things, you only won one. Those other nine took a lot of time and a lot of effort and a lot of money. I'm not going to award you the cost to pursue those unsuccessful claims. All of what you just issued, identified, Your Honor, are things that the landlord ultimately prevailed on. There was a change in controlling law regarding the expiration of the moratorium. There was a change in decisional law regarding the language of whether seriously endangers requires an ongoing violation. The Fairmont case ultimately decided that wasn't the law, and that was the basis of our first petition for a mandamus for the issuance of a summons in the first place and the first appeal. I mean, the trial court dismissed the first case without prejudice because there wasn't an ongoing violation. Fairmont concluded that's not what the law means. And so for every issue that you've just identified, the landlord ultimately did prevail.
All right, I appreciate it. I see your time has expired, and you will have some time on rebuttal.
Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Lisa Hollingsworth, and I'm here this morning on behalf of the defendants, Michael Alexander and Patricia Davis. They're the respondents in this matter. They were the tenants at Olson Properties. I would like to start where Judge Johnson did, which is what did the appellant do to preserve this matter? And I think that makes this an easy case. There's a case that appellant cites in its reply brief that's called Faith Tech Inc. versus Aurora Distributed Solar LLC. It's an unpublished case. It's at 2020 Westlaw 3172835. There's a quote in that case where the court was going to reverse a failure to award costs and disbursements, and it says, quote, Faith reserved its right to submit a 119.02 affidavit until after the district court determined whether Faith was entitled to receive attorney's fees. As you know, Judge Johnson, there were post-trial briefs in this. There was extensive post-trial briefing in this case, and there was absolutely no mention of costs, fees, or disbursements in appellant's post-trial brief. It may be hard for the court to tell that because it somehow didn't make it into the record, but that makes it even more clear that that issue was not preserved.
Just to, before you proceed any further, I was trying to catch up to you, and I was looking at that case, and I'm wondering, it seems limited to attorney's fees. Is it also cost disbursements, or we're only looking at attorney's fees at this point?
I think that, so to the extent that the 119.02 affidavit contemplates both attorney's fees and some disbursements because disbursements are something that's specifically included in a 119.02 affidavit. I think it relates to those issues. Those issues obviously have variable dollar amounts attached to them, and for that reason, there needs to be a specific and not just a general request. There's no way that a trial court could conceivably rule on a motion or a non-motion, make an award of costs and of fees and disbursements without a specific ask, and that just did not happen here. The issue of
is it fair to interpret the argument of appellant as saying, you know, the district court erred by preemptively curtailing or precluding plaintiff appellant from seeking cost disbursements and attorney fees?
You know, so there was, first of all, again, there was an opportunity to make a specific request. If appellant had simply in their post-trial brief said, hold up, I'd like to preserve my right to file a 119.02 affidavit if I'm the prevailing party, we wouldn't be here.
Right, but the question, isn't the question, were they required to do that? Or can they, that might be a good idea, but does it preclude them from appealing an order that denies it? That's the question I have.
Well, I think that there's a big Thiel v. Stitch problem if they've never made the specific request.
The complaint isn't enough to get around a Thiel v. Stitch problem. So they make the complaint. There's sort of a practice, an understood practice, that there's a sequence to these things, and they were waiting to become prevailing before then coming in with this 119.02, and they never had that chance. At that point, they can ask for reconsideration, but what precludes them from appealing the denial if it's in the complaint?
I think that's bad practice for this court to get into, to make it be the trial court's job to leave open the issue of costs, fees, and disbursements in every case. There's no finality there for the parties. You know, if appellant had asked, we would have responded, but appellant never asked. And so we're here, and, you know, we don't have the finality we would otherwise have.
So, I mean, I'm looking at that same case. It concludes by saying, however, a district court abuses its discretion by denying a motion without providing a rationale.
Right, denying a motion, exactly. There's no motion here.
So denying a claim without a rationale is not abuse of discretion. They have discretion to deny a claim made in a complaint without any rationale, but no discretion if it's a motion?
Well, you know, eviction actions are, you know, pled pretty bare bones, right? And sometimes they have a lot of claims in them. And the landlord plaintiff decides which of those claims to then pursue at trial and at post-trial. And sometimes they don't pursue, sometimes they do. Here, where there was no specific request, I think the trial court did not abuse its discretion in saying, well, I guess they're not asking for those.
But isn't it true that, I mean, based on Rule 54, disbursements are usually requested after the judgment, and attorney's fees usually in a motion regarding 119?
Yep. And that didn't happen. And I don't, as you mentioned earlier, I don't think that there's anything that would have precluded from appellant from doing that. If appellant had simply said, you know, the best place to have preserved that would have been in the post-trial brief, right? But if the appellant didn't do that and was surprised by the trial court judge's order, they absolutely could have filed a motion. They weren't...
A motion for what? What exactly would the form or the mechanism be?
I would have filed a motion for probably amended findings,
right,
and then...
So that's the question. Where's the case law that says failure to do that is forfeiting the issue on appeal?
I don't know that there is case law on that, but I think that there... I don't think that this court wants to get into the business of it being permissible to raise for the first time on appeal that you were seeking costs, fees, and disbursements in any real and meaningful way.
I guess but doesn't Rule 54 kind of do that already by saying a deadline that has as a precondition something that in this case is, there was no 45 days to do so because it was denied. So it's almost as if the argument is the district court erred because it prevented Rule 54 from being applicable.
To me, it seems like, you know, the way that this should have moved is, if the ask wasn't made in the post-trial brief, then the ask should have been made to the trial court. If the trial court still denied that, then I think there is a separately appealable judgment. The judge still could have directed court administration to enter a new judgment, which likely would have happened, and that would have been the appeal mechanism, not this.
While I'm talking about Rule 54, I just wanted to ask your mm-hmm. opinion. Do you see that, you know, I said the argument is almost as if they're saying the error is in not applying or preventing 54 from being applied.
Mm-hmm.
Do you believe that that's an argument presented to this court? anything about Rule 54?
No.
And similarly, the specific statute that relates to mandatory automatic costs in an eviction case to the prevailing party that wasn't cited, do you think that's presented to this court, or is that something we are unable to consider?
I don't think that the 504B costs are before the court. I think that the costs that are before the court are the $205.50 in 549.02. And
maybe you can educate me on what the difference is, and like if there are certain costs in the eviction that statute specifically is limited to, and the costs requested here are somehow different, and that's why we're only looking at the general. I didn't know that there might be a distinction there. To me, it seemed costs were costs.
And usually representing tenants and not seeking costs very often, I'm not very sure. I know that there is that Mid-Minnesota Legal Assistance had a case at the Court of Appeals a couple of years ago, and we were looking for it at our briefing, and I don't see it. But that case was a denial of the award of costs, and this court specifically in that case referenced 549.02 and awarded the $205.50. I think the additional cost that 504B could be contemplating is the filing fee, which is, I don't know what that is right now. It's about $267 or something like that right now. So there could be the, in addition to just the statutory $205.50 costs, I imagine 504B contemplates those attorneys, or the filing fee as well.
I'm thinking about the question, like, if the landlord had had applied for disbursements after the judgment, and then there were proceedings on that, and there was eventually another judgment of the district court solely on the issue of costs,
mm-hmm.
What's your position on whether that judgment would have been appealable?
If it's a judgment, I think it would have been appealable. And 504B, the exclusive remedy is appeal from judgment, but it's appeal from judgment, so.
I guess I'm wondering, so does 504B limit appeals only to the judgment of, how do we say it, the merits or the right to possession only?
I wouldn't see it as being that limiting because it would probably just be an amended judgment, and so it would still be effectively the same judgment could both determine possession and the finality of cost, fees, and disbursements. But as Mr. Kella notes, we do a lot of this, but we do very little in the area of cost, fees, and disbursements for the reason that he indicates, which is that our clients are primarily very low-income individuals who are typically judgment-proof.
Separate question with respect to attorney's fees. Let's say if, hypothetically, if this court were to remand and for further proceedings in the district court about attorney fees, am I correct in assuming that you would take the position that not all the fees incurred on behalf of Olson Properties from the very beginning of this dispute? I mean, are you... Do you have some sort of, in the big picture, some ways of objecting to some of those attorney fees?
Right. So not to get too in the weeds of a very convoluted procedural history, but this case started with 19 AV CV 2014-79. That case, initially a summons didn't issue because of the pandemic event. Plaintiff sought a writ of mandamus. Plaintiff sought a petition for further review to the Supreme Court.
And we're familiar with all of that history.
Yeah.
So that's the reason for my question.
Right. So that entire first eviction, the 19 AV CV 2014-79, plaintiff was never the prevailing party in anything involving that action. But
the order that I'm looking at from September of 2022 is sort of double captioned. It has two case numbers at the top.
They were when the second, the 2021 case was initially, so when 19 ABCV 21-1607 was filed on September 13th, 2021, that was proceeding separately, and then the two cases were finally consolidated sometime in early 2022.
Maybe it's sufficient to say that your answer to my original question is probably yes.
Sure.
You would have objections to attorney fees if there were if Olson Properties request everything since the very beginning of the
state. Exactly. There's many times that the tenant defendants
I'd like
prevailed.
To ask a follow-up question, and it sort of goes back to where I ended with Mr. Kala. That same point you're making about this point in time and this case and they weren't prevailing, are you in your brief mm-hmm. arguing that appellant was not the prevailing party?
I think that we have to concede that appellant was the ultimate prevailing party, but the tenants prevailed in the entirety of the 2020 eviction until it was consolidated with the 2021 eviction. And so, you know, I don't think that mere prevailing party analysis would get to an automatic result that they were entitled to
that,
cost fees
that
and
that becomes sort of, and I know I understand that time's out, so I'll be quick. Is it possible the district court would agree with that and denied on the grounds that the appellant wasn't the prevailing party?
I think that's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
My time is up, so thank you.
I'm not going to get into the prevailing party
well,
issue.
I wish you would for sure. This reason. I think if it's possible the district court just misapplied the statute and erred, then that's your argument, right? But if it's also possible the district court concluded that your client was not the prevailing party and denied on those grounds, then we have two different rationales for the same order. And it's hard for us to review what the district court did if we don't know which of those it is. And then you tie in, I would assume, your response to the argument about that unpublished case that says, however, denying a motion without a rationale is an abuse of discretion. So the lacking of a rationale here, given the two different alternative possibilities, seems to be an obstacle to our review. So I would like you to address that aspect as we're going to have to wrestle with that.
Respectfully, I disagree. I think it's a mandate for your review to remand, to ask the court to explain why it did not, or to at least allow the landlord to make its submission for attorney's fees, costs, and disbursements, and then provide a detailed rationale for the court's decision. But to simply offer nothing, leaves this court speculating. Is there a reason, perhaps, by the tenants that the court didn't think they were prevailing because so much time was spent chasing down all these rabbit holes that shouldn't be compensated? Maybe. But we don't know because there was no explanation. And that's where the abuse of discretion comes in. And that's where the remand becomes required. Now, I take great issue with Ms. Hollingsworth's characterization that eviction one and all the time spent on that did not result in the landlord being prevailing.
And I didn't mean for you to
sure.
respond to that in the brief time that you had, but I appreciate your response to my question.
I mean, had the reasoning of Fairmont Housing been at present state of mind with Judge Lutz from the district court to issue the summons, or the Court of Appeals on the mandamus issue, had they been predicting how the Fairmont decision would come out, and understand that eventually we're going to realize that seriously endangers does not require an ongoing violation, this case would have been resolved long ago. There wouldn't have been a need for all that. But all those issues ultimately came down in the landlord's favor. It just took a long time to get there. And that it takes a long time to get there doesn't minimize who the prevailing party is. Yes, Ms. Hollingsworth prevailed on a lot of interim issues along the way. But ultimately, all of those issues came back in favor of the landlord, all of them. The removal to federal court remanded back down to state court. The dismissal without prejudice based off of ongoing violation, change in decisional law. All of those came back in favor of the landlord. It just took a long time to get there. There's a bit of discussion regarding post-trial briefs and post-judgment practice. The briefs were submitted after the trial, before the judgment. The attorney's fees issue was in the complaint. And oftentimes, in a normal civil proceeding, once that judgment is entered, the rules allow for a post-judgment application for attorney's fees, costs, and disbursements. But as Your Honor indicated, the judge cut that off. Now, could I have sent a letter to the court, alert them to the time frame of 504B371? Your Honor, let's get this done in 15 days so we don't have an appeal issue. Maybe the judge's clerk, maybe the judge responds promptly and says, you're right, we made a mistake. Let's get this taken care of. Let's get this taken care of in less than 2 weeks so we don't have an issue where the Court of Appeals might view the trial court as improperly tolling or delaying or extending the time frame under 371 to get an appeal from judgment. We don't want that to happen. But what if the trial court comes back and takes longer than 15 days and says, no, we meant what we said. We're not going to grant you attorney's fees and costs disbursements, and I don't feel I need to explain that any further. What is the landlord then to do? Appeal from that order denying my motion, my post-judgment motion? And then what is the tenant going to do? Mr. Colley, you should have appealed within 15 days of 371 from the judgment denying your attorney's fees and costs and disbursements. There's lots of things that could have happened that might have resulted in a better outcome. But there's no guarantee that would have happened on the time frame necessary. And like Your Honor said, Judge Bryan, that's not a requirement. And the failure to do that is not fatal to the landlord's objection here that the court erred by not providing a rationale for denial.
Thank you very much for your arguments this morning and your written submission. We will take the matter under advisement and issue an opinion within the statutory.
Thank you.
Have a nice day. And that concludes the oral argument portion of the court's calendar this morning. Thank you. The court stands in recess.